This is the first question. Which is a better way, to spend £20? The God Delusion, a book on molecular biology, or a Bible commentary? Hey, that is a good question. Well, for £18, you can get all three of those books. I would say molecular biology, I'm obviously very enthusiastic about. Bible commentary, definitely. God Delusion is up to you. Or open-minded. Okay, here's a little more serious question. If science and religion are not to be pitted directly against each other, as you say, why are they so often in secular arguments against Christianity? What can we do more effectively to get these distinctions across? I think that's a very important question, and I think what's really important is that we, and I'm speaking sort of as a scientist here, that we don't try and invest scientific theories with all kind of ideological baggage. And actually, Darwinian evolution is a classic example of that. I mean, evolution has been used since 1859 in support of capitalism, socialism, racism, atheism, just about every ism that you can possibly imagine. And I think it's very important. I mean, I think it's important for the health of science and for the health of the scientific community that we don't try and utilize scientific arguments for polemical, kind of ideological reasons. In fact, in the Faraday Institute, which I'm part of in Cambridge, we're running a workshop, a writer's workshop in September. We've got some really great people coming to write chapters on a book. But the theme is the social, political, and religious transformations of biology from 1600 to the present day. And I think it's a fascinating topic, actually, to just look at all the ways in which biology have been used, in all kinds of ways by people trying to use the prestige of a scientific theory to try and support their particular point of view, whether it's political or philosophical, whatever it might be. So I think there needs to be a lot of education, in the general public arena, to say, look, let science do what it's good at doing, and don't try and attach all kinds of other theories along for a kind of free ride. And I think that's really why, I mean, I quoted from a number of atheists who are quite critical of Dawkins. That's one reason why they do get upset, because he's trying to utilize the prestige of science to support metaphysical theories that really can't be supported by science either way. I mean, science is simply not up to this sort of Herculean task of adjudicating between different meta-scientific beliefs. So I think that's a really important part of education in schools, and I think school teachers have a responsibility in the science classroom or RE, wherever it might be, to actually point out, that science is just doing its job of helping us to explain this particular slice of the physical world, whatever it might be, and you can absorb it. You can absorb it into any kind of religious system you like. It's up to you, but that's something different, okay? So I think that's really important. And the early founders of the Royal Society in the 17th century made a specific decision that they would not discuss politics or religion in their own proceedings, and they would stick to natural philosophy. And that created space in order to investigate the properties of the world without getting bogged down in all this other stuff. And I'm afraid that these days there are people, only a few actually, I mean, don't think that Dawkins is typical of the scientific community. Definitely not. Definitely not. There's just a very small subset of people, but they're very vocal and they have the ear of the media, and they're trying to utilize the prestige of science to build a platform for particular metaphysical views, and I think that is unfortunate. So I think the answer to the question really is more education. I've been flashing up some of the Faraday courses we have. I would like to do a plug for those. We have these weekend courses for busy people. Come up for a weekend to Cambridge and just spend 48 hours in a crash course on science religion, where we try and bring in really good speakers as part of education, to educate people at least about the issues that are actually involved in the discussion. This question, why do you think Dawkins is so keen, to dismiss the Christian faith? Yeah, that's a very good question. And the answer is, I honestly don't know. I really don't know. I mean, he's written a fair bit about his background and his upbringing, and had a pretty standard sort of nominal Anglican type of respectable background, as far as I can see from his writings. So I really don't know. I mean, good question to ask him next time you meet him, I would say to the person who wrote this question. But it is a bit odd. I mean, many of my secular colleagues, I have to say, out in the laboratory, they don't believe in God, but they just really puzzle. Why would somebody be so bitterly anti-religious? It doesn't actually make sense. They say, well, I'm an atheist, but You know, I wouldn't go to all that effort. You know, what would be the point? We're living in a postmodern society where sort of, what's the point of expending all that energy to have a sort of anti-religious kind of crusade? And it is a bit puzzling. And the answer is, I don't really know, actually. So anyone who knows, please come and tell me afterwards, and I'll be interested to find out. But next question. I'm trying to keep these fairly thematic as far as I can. Why does Dawkins stop at Christianity and religion? Doesn't his thinking destroy all ideology, morality, and purpose, whether religious or not? I think that is true, actually. If you really took his viewpoint consistently, I mean, in many of his writings, he sounds like an arch reductionist, and he has these sort of wonderful quotes, the only reason for living is to pass on our DNA to succeeding generations and so forth. But I mean, clearly he doesn't really believe that. He believes, one reason for living is to write books, and to influence people and give lectures all over America and, all kinds of things. So clearly he has a purpose in life. So I think actually I have lots of atheist friends, but I have pessimistic atheist friends and I have optimistic atheist friends. And the pessimistic atheist friends really struggle with this sense of the meaninglessness of life. I mean, genuinely they do, and really see, if this life is all there is, then what's the point kind of thing. So I think, and that's obviously been a great driver of poetry and literature and plays and all kinds of stuff. Then you have the sunny and optimistic atheists who say, who knows, we just got to live life as it is and rather pragmatically get on with life, which of course you have to do, you've got to live a life. So I think though if you are really consistent, that I would say you probably have to end up more on the pessimistic side, because if this life is all there is, then, what is the point? And especially when you think of the timescale of the history of the universe and the very, very small part that our own lives play in that. So I think a more consistent commitment to the position that Dawkins takes probably would destroy all ideology, morality, and purpose. But I think in practice, people just can't do that. They have to live a life, and so you get this tension going on, where you have to have a biography, you have to construct a biography. And it's interesting, by the way, that Dawkins has said a couple of times, and he says it at the end of The Selfish Gene, that despite all I've said about the selfish gene and so forth, I don't want to give the impression that you should be nasty to people. You should be nice to people, and you should practice, good morality and be kind to people and so on. Which is great. I'm relieved about that. But the question is, where does that come from? What's the rational basis for that kind of moral ethical position? I think there's a real intellectual discordance there, actually, which is worth highlighting. Okay, here's another question. It says at the top, question one. This is slightly ominous. What's question two? But anyway, question one. So if we take the sum total of all the data, bracket, science, history, etc., human experience, does the data suggest that the probability that God does exist exceeds the probability that he does not exist? Good question. Yeah. I mean, obviously, everyone's got to weigh it up for themselves. Everyone has, everyone brings in their personal experience into this. We're not born as blank slates. We're brought up in an environment. We have, let's face it, we all have beliefs and prejudices and all kinds of things mixed up in our heads, which comes from our education and our parents and our families, what happened to us in life, and so on and so on and so on. So none of us comes to the data in exactly the same way as the person next door to us. I mean, it's impossible. We're all going to weigh the data slightly differently. I was fascinated, by the way, to listen to a Chinese lady just 2 weeks ago. I go to a church in Cambridge, which has the habit of, baptizing people in the pool, like they did in the New Testament, right down, when they become a Christian. So this Chinese lady was giving an account of what happened to her. How did she come? And she was explaining how she came out of a completely atheistic framework in mainland China. She'd never, ever heard about Jesus or about the Bible or about anything, nothing. So she comes to Cambridge as an undergraduate, actually, and very, very sharp girl, very, very bright. So, and then she starts being attracted to the morality of Jesus and his teaching in the Sermon on the Mount. And she's really attracted to that, and she studies it with somebody for a term and so forth. But at the end of the term, she goes off on the holidays, and she said, well, I don't believe in God, so it doesn't, so therefore I can't go any further with this. It's very nice, but I can't go any further. Comes back to Cambridge, is in her part two biochemistry lecture of all things. You wouldn't expect that to be a domain for people coming to believe in God. But she's listening to how DNA is packed into every cell of the body. I don't know if you know that. If you unwrap all the DNA in every cell of your body, in every cell, it'll unwrap about 2 meters long. It's beautifully packed. It's just incredible sort of feat of engineering, really, to get that DNA packed up into each cell of the body. And she was listening to all this, and she suddenly sat there and she thought, there's got to be a God. Just like that. You know. Now, it wasn't really a sort of rational argument in that way. I mean, she never heard of intelligent design, all these sort of arguments, and all these complicated things. No, it was simply kind of an insight into the beauty, really, of biology. You know, biology is very beautiful. The cell is an incredibly beautiful thing. So it was this sort of insight, really. And so she thought, now I believe in God. Oh, I believe in the teaching of Jesus already, so I better become a Christian. So that's how she became a Christian, you see. So from total atheism, around this very sort of convoluted pilgrimage. And I just think everybody is very, very different when they come to faith. But if you're asking me, of course, if you weigh up the balance of evidence, well, you may say I'm biased, but you know, it seems to me to come down to the inference to the best explanation seems to me to be that there is a God who is there, who exists, who does actually have intentions and purposes for this universe. Because, you know, we scientists, we like explanations for things. And in a way, atheism simply says, it puts a blocker. It says, well, we don't know. So you have to take the universe as a brute fact. I don't find that very satisfactory. I mean, I think if you look around the world, you feel as if you're living in the midst of a drama and you're one of the actors in the play. You know, one has a struggle for justice and you're trying to help poverty and address that and all these different things. You're practicing all this morality. You're in the middle of a great moral drama, really. And if you then go away and say, well, you know, what is the best explanation for all that? I think a dramatist. You know, that seems to me a fairly reasonable kind of conclusion, that actually it's an indicator of something, a bigger story, an upper level narrative, as we've been trying to explain it, that there is a different narrative there which gives a whole, incorporates all these other narratives within it. Now, I don't think that at all is a knockdown evidence for God. I mean, clearly, you know, these things are pretty finely balanced. It's not as if it's absolutely overwhelming. Otherwise, obviously, everybody in the world would believe in God. Obviously, they don't. So, but I think that's how I would see it, you know, that it seems to me that theism is a better explanation for the world that I see around me rather than simply saying the universe exists as a brute fact. And this is a relevant, I'm trying to group these in a way, and I think this is a connected question. What falsifiable evidence is there, therefore, for the God you believe in? As the first century is no longer testable, how do you know theologians and the authors of the Bible didn't make it up? Yeah, so this is really about a question about the historicity of the New Testament texts and all of that kind of thing. I mean, we could spend a long time in that kind of area. But I would just make the general comment that I think you can certainly come to the New Testament accounts as a collection of really interesting historical documents, you know, stemming from the first century, of which we do have actually very early documentary copies compared to many of the other historical events of that era. So I would simply say, you know, the historical documents are pretty good, actually. And after all, I think most people accept, you know, that the Gospels, I mean, the whole New Testament was put together by AD 90 or by the end of the first century. We're talking about a few decades for most of the writings of the death of Jesus. Certainly the background, the places mentioned and so forth are historically rooted and so forth and so on. So we could get into a long discussion about that. But I think there it's simply a question of weighing up the historical data that's out there and reading up on it and so forth. So I probably might not want to say more than that. Then this is another more theological question. The God of the Old Testament wiping out the earth's population except Noah and his family seems very different from the God of the New Testament who allows his son Jesus to be sacrificed. Why this inconsistency? This is the old kind of rather familiar, I have to say, argument of trying to pit, as it were, the image and the understanding of God from the Old Testament with that found in the New Testament. Now, I think I just wanted to make 2 points about that. One is that clearly there is a developing revelation of God and his character in the Bible. I mean, certainly all Christians would believe that. Just to take one classic example, I mean, there is really no teaching about the afterlife in the Old Testament except for this sort of shady Sheol type of idea they had of a kind of underworld where people went. But there's really no concept of heaven or hell and all that. So I always think it's kind of ironic, actually, that when people say, oh, well, you religious people make all this stuff up because either, and then you get two arguments, either you're scared of hell or because you think heaven is so wonderful and so on. You say, well, actually, in the whole Old Testament, they didn't have that belief. So, you know, the actual basis for the whole of what Christians believe now, which is rooted in Judaism, of course, in the Old Testament theology, there was no belief in the afterlife in the sense that's revealed in the New Testament. So clearly there is a development of the understanding of God and of his will and so forth. But at the same time, there's a huge amount of continuity, and some of the most wonderful passages actually about the love of God are in the Old Testament. If you read Isaiah and the Psalms, and very, you know, very sort of personal kind of writing by the poets about God's love, as well as his judgment. And actually, if you want to read some of the most stringent statements about judgment in the whole of the Bible, you know where you want to go is the teaching of Jesus, actually. You know, he was pretty hard, actually, in some of his statements. So I don't sort of buy this idea, you know, that we have this really tough kind of judgmental God in the Old Testament and then this very loving kind of wishy-washy sort of God in the New Testament. I don't see that when I read the Bible. I think if you read the whole Bible, I think you'll get a more balanced picture, actually, I think, of both the love of God and indeed his strong antipathy towards sin and our own selfishness as well. And I think they both come through pretty clearly. But I am certainly agreeing for development through the Bible in terms of greater knowledge about God. Okay, so here's one then more a little bit about evolution. Could you please give your view on intelligent design versus evolution? I would just say, I mean, for those who aren't familiar with what intelligent design is, it's not the old classic argument from design that goes way back to the Stoics. It's not what it's about. Okay, so intelligent design is a recent movement that started in the early 1990s through a lawyer from California called Phil Johnson, and then has been developed by a number of other writers and has gained some notoriety because of the conflict in the American education system about the teaching of evolution in schools and so forth. Intelligent design is trying to say that there are certain entities in biology that are so complex, they're irreducibly complex, and therefore they display signs of design, as it's called. And the key thing here to understand is that people want to say, the intelligent design proponents want to say that actually design should be part of the scientific curriculum. You know, this is a scientific theory and so forth. I have to say I'm not terribly keen myself on that kind of idea for a number of different reasons, actually. But, I mean, one of the reasons is it doesn't look to me to have any of the normal qualities that a theory does have in science. I mean, I think scientists are pretty used to recognizing when something is a scientific theory. A scientific theory leads to testable, to be able to test it. It's a testable hypothesis. It leads to a research program, where you know what to tell your PhD student when they come in your office and want to know the next, the next experiment to do. I mean, if I have a PhD student in my lab and they say I've been working on the bacterial flagellum, you know, for 10 years, or no, I shouldn't say that, 2 years, and I really can't understand how this thing came into being, so I think it's designed. You know, I'm not going to receive that very warmly, I have to say. I will just say, well, just go back in the lab and try a bit harder, you know. So. Sorry, we're very hard, you know, on these things. But the bottom line is that science is trying to extend its understanding of material things as much as possible. So we don't want to put a blocker in the way. And simply saying it's design doesn't actually help us in the lab to understand it any more than we did before. You know, it doesn't really help us to understand that. So that's one problem. And then the other problem is that actually one is then mingling, one's bringing it another level. Actually, it's mingling up those two levels that we talked about before. So design is really a philosophical language or religious language, whatever you want, but it's not really scientific language, not in the sense which the intelligent design people are trying to use it. It's actually bringing in philosophy into something which really just want to understand how these 30 components of the flagellum fit together and, you know, how different bits of them were acted upon by natural selection, which I think they were, actually. As a matter of interest, there are 10 of those proteins, by the way, in the bacterial flagellum actually form a little module, which is called the type 3 secretory system, which bacteria use to inject toxins into other bacteria. And so that seems to have evolved independently as a module, which has its own. It's under selection pressure to do that particular task. And so when you actually start breaking down, I mean, the immune system that I work on is far more complex than a bacterial flagellum. And yet, I think we understand quite a lot about the evolution of the immune system, actually. We don't know all the detail for sure, but we know that a lot of the receptors go way back in evolutionary time. You find them in Drosophila and fruit flies and all these things, and so forth. So, you know, that's how you kind of build up a picture of what's going on. There is I don't want to go on too long about intelligent design, but there is just one theological critique I would want to make, actually. And I think this is rather important as well, that I was mentioning earlier on that really I think a proper biblical understanding of God as creator is a God who is the author of creation. He's the one who brings into being and sustains everything that exists. So there's either an author or there isn't an author. So the Christian belief is there is an author, and he's upholding everything through, if you like, secondary causes, but still he is the ultimate cause of all that exists as creator. And it seems to me that what you find, rather, in the intelligent design writers is this tendency to divide things up into two. So you have the sort of what they call the naturalistic bits of the creation or natural world and so forth, which science can understand. But then you have these other bits over here which got designed for some special reason, whether it's a flagellum or whatever it might be. And I think that's a pretty theologically suspect kind of way of looking at the created order. I think all we as scientists can do is try and understand how God has worked in the created order as best we can. And whether we were ignorant about a particular bit of it or not, you know, I don't really think makes any difference. So it does come actually back to sort of God of the gaps type of argument, I think, intelligent design. It's sort of putting design now, the designer or the design, into that gap in our current understanding. And I think that's not satisfactory, really, in theological terms. Okay, so we've got another little bunch of questions. Right. Okay, so here's a good one. Faced with a choice between potentially infinite beliefs, I think lots of beliefs, why choose any? Why not attempt to stay neutral, accepting that all beliefs have equal claim to truth? Why, in fact, chase the truth? That's a very good question. Okay, I've got two answers to that. I think the first answer is, as I was sort of hinting earlier on, I actually think in real life, you have to make decisions. You have to make moral decisions, ethical decisions, decisions about what you're going to do with your life, how you invest it, all kinds of things, which actually depend upon your own belief system, which is actually meta-scientific. So, you know, you're actually committed. I think everyone, as I was trying to suggest earlier on, is actually existentially committed to a belief system, whether they actually want to be or not. It's just a fact of being a human being, actually. I think it's a basic characteristic of humanity that we're all committed to a certain set of beliefs that actually does influence what we do with our lives and whether we fiddle our tax returns or not, or whether we commit adultery or not, or, you know, lots of other things. That's influenced by our belief system. So being neutral, I think, is not a realistic option, to be quite honest. I mean, if we didn't have to live a life, you know, we sat on top of a pillar in the middle of the Syrian desert, that sort of thing, maybe. But, you know, real people in real living situations of daily life, and the hustle bustle of the city or wherever we might be, you can't stay neutral about your beliefs. At the end of the day, we are committed to making decisions about things that reflect metaphysical commitments. So that's one reason. The other reason is why, in fact, chase the truth. Well, I think, you know, given I think it's a fact that we are metaphysically committed, we can't avoid that. Well, we might as well come up with a decent set of beliefs, you know, let's go for the good ones. So it seems to me, given that's a fact, well, in that case, let's really try and make sure that our metaphysical beliefs are as coherent and justifiable as possible. Now, of course, as a scientist in particular, we actually, unlike some of the most postmodern people, we actually have a quest for truth. You know, we actually believe in science that some things are true and others are false. You know, I know you can't really do that in every branch. Some of the humanities would just want to listen to your opinions about something as long as you can justify your opinion. But in science, we actually do believe in such things, old-fashioned things, as truth and falsehood. You know, that DNA is a double helix. It's not a triple helix. That's true everywhere in the world, and so forth. So I think particularly for people with a scientific training, it's maybe easier to chase that truth, as the question is putting it in some ways. I think it's easier, perhaps, than people in the humanities who are much more used to, just as long as you justify your opinion about something, there's no final truth you're going to come to. But let me come back to the point. I think as far as life is concerned and the way we live our lives and what we do with our lives, I think we're existentially committed. We're already committed to a metaphysical truth system. Okay, so, right. Now, sorry, I haven't read these before, so. Dr. Alexander, are there any areas where you find your faith in conflict with scientific thought? If so, how do you resolve the issue? Actually, to be quite honest, I mean, I was already a Christian when I came into the scientific community down the road in the Institute of Psychiatry, nearly 40 years ago, I have to confess. So I can't say, to be honest, that I've ever found any conflict, actually, between my faith and my science in terms of the basic understanding. Where I think there are always challenges all the time are in the ethical issues. I've certainly had questions raised by my science in the ethical arena about what to do, you know, whether I should do that bit of science or not. And that comes up all the time, and that's a really important question for all scientists. But, you know, as far as the basic relationship between science and faith, I can't say. In fact, rather the opposite, actually. The more I go on to understand the amazing complexities of the immune system and the brain and so forth, I mean, the more I'm amazed, actually, by God's creation. So I see it going the other way, actually, that science strengthens faith. And what's very striking, by the way, just in passing, is one thing we've noticed a lot is if you look at the population, if you look at the Christian community in Cambridge, there are far more Christians amongst the scientists than there are in the humanities. Okay, and that's true in the churches, at the undergraduate level, and in professorial chairs, wherever you look. Okay, now, that runs counter, actually, to the sort of public perception, doesn't it? But I think, I mean, if one had to come up with reasons, I think a lot of it is to do with this sort of shared history that we have between science and faith. There's a very close history between science and Christian faith, particularly. And so that gives similar ways of thinking, actually, between science and faith. And as I say, you know, we share, a shared kind of critique and unhappiness about the more extreme forms of postmodernity, because if you really believe everything is relative, as perhaps in the more extreme forms of postmodernity, then you wouldn't be able to do science, you know, because science actually believes in making up your mind that something is the case and something else is not the case. Is there any, this has another part to this question, is there any scientific paper or research that has made you alter your faith view? Not really. No, sorry, there's not. Like I say, you know, it hasn't made very much difference. So, right, we're going to go for the last one. So I'm going to have to... boys, there's some great questions here. As I said, we'd have to be here until 5 o'clock in the morning. Okay, here's a short question, but it's actually quite a long... I mean, I won't give the long answer. Why are there so many religions? Why are there so many religions in the world today? Well, you know, it's a fascinating thing, isn't it? As anthropologists have realized for more than a century, it's very, very hard, perhaps it's impossible, to find any culture, any place in the world which doesn't have a religion. And that's pretty interesting, isn't it? Now, there's lots of kind of interesting explanations about that. But the bottom line is, you know, everybody who lives on this planet wants to find out, what are they doing here? You know, what's the point of being here? I mean, that's probably a good question. And it doesn't matter where you are and what language you have. I mean, that's a pretty pressing sort of question to have. And people answer it many different ways. So there's lots of different religions, lots of different answers. So, I mean, it just shows the universality of religion. I think that's an important point. We are made to know God. We are made to find out meaning in life. And that's clearly characteristic in the billions of people around the world in what we actually observe. So that's an important observation. The fact of diversity is simply you know, that, I mean, lots and lots of people have different views about this. But, I'll just put this right at the end, it is possible to, as it were, accumulate various religious beliefs in modules, just as we have a modular view of the mind. So you can have a modular view of religion, and you can have your Abrahamic faiths, theism, you can have your monistic faiths, Taoism, Buddhism, Hinduism over here, you can have more kind of spirituality and so forth. So you can actually start divide the different religious beliefs into modules. And if you're into comparative religion, that does help a lot, I think, in beginning to address them and so forth. So perhaps I shall close with that. Chairman's winning.